WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
DU.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We all grow up hearing about superstitions. At one time or another, we may have tried not to step on a crack on the sidewalk. After all, we wouldn't want to break our grandmother's back. Some recoil at the sight of a black cat crossing their path. Others have resorted to keeping their fingers crossed when facing an upcoming challenge for good luck. And of course, you know it's bad luck to break a mirror. 7 years bad luck, in fact. It is also bad luck to open an umbrella indoors or walk under a ladder. All of these are superstitions, but where did they come from? Why do they persist? And is there any truth to any of them? To help us get the answers to those and other questions, we've assembled a panel of 13 guests. And then we were told that we not only could our studio not accommodate them, but that number is extremely unlucky. So we've narrowed it down to a panel of three. Scott Fluke is co-author of Reexamining the Form and Function of Superstition and a school psychology doctoral student at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he joins us this morning. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Dr. Joe Nickel is Senior Research Fellow of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. CSI,
hello.
For short. Yeah, hello. That's an international scientific organization and investigative columnist for Skeptical Inquirer magazine, who has become widely known as an investigator of myths and mysteries, frauds, forgeries, and hoaxes. He was an inspiration for Hilary Swank's role as a miracle investigator in The Reaping. He's also a former professional magician and detective. My goodness, when do you have time to sleep?
Well, I'm sorry you've used up all the time of our show.
Well, not quite.
Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. And in our studio, we welcome back Dr. Sean McLeod, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte and an American Studies and Communication Studies faculty affiliate there. His current book project is on a branch of evangelicals who practice spiritual warfare against demons that they believe are residing in human bodies, material objects, and certain geographic locations. So the devil makes them do it? Is that it?
It's not a boring topic, I'll tell you. Good morning.
Good morning. Okay, Dr. Nickel, you've written more than 20 books dealing with mysteries and disappearances and psychic phenomenon and miracles and things like that. Where do superstitions figure into all of those things?
Well, basically, when we don't have an actual explanation for something, and science, you know, is a rather modern invention, people just made something up. They, some bad accident happened, and people cast about to see what had happened, and so maybe somebody remembered that they had walked under a ladder, or they had a black cat had crossed their path, and they associated one with the other.
But why, maybe a tabby cat had crossed their path. The tabby didn't get a bad name out of it, though.
Well, if that had happened, of course, the black cat probably comes from the witches' familiar. The witches, everybody knows, had black cats. But we have to be careful when we ascribe origins to these superstitions. There are whole compendia of these superstitions, encyclopedias, and so forth, the superstition. And as soon as you find one very positive explanation for where one came from, you find in another book another very positive one. And the fact is that most of them they originated in the very distant past, and we have no idea where they really came
now. Witches. He mentioned witches. Witches have an origin in religion, whether that religion is Wiccan or they're being fought off by Christians in Massachusetts, or by Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. But Dr. McLeod, how many superstitions that we know about, things common superstitions, have their origins in religion?
A lot of superstitions have their origins in religion. Take bless you, for example. So if I were to sneeze right now, you might want to say bless you to me. Bless you comes from medieval Europe and the notion that if you sneezed, your soul actually left your body. So quickly, you would need to be blessed somehow so that the soul would enter the body again.
See, I thought it was because your heart stopped. People thought your heart stopped when you sneezed. So you're telling me that the soul, it was thought that the soul left the body.
When you sneezed, it actually exited, yes.
Okay. And Scott, you see superstition and religions as being totally separate. Is that right?
Yeah. Religion is somewhat bigger in my mind. A religion can have a lot of superstitions as a part of it. But just because somebody is religious doesn't make them superstitious. And just because somebody is superstitious doesn't make them a religious person.
Go ahead.
And this is where I would, as a religious studies scholar, disagree that I think the boundary between superstition and religion is a lot of the times about social power and habituated assumptions rather than some sort of natural difference. And in fact, we find a lot of apotraic magic, a lot of things that we do to try to cure sicknesses, to ward off bad things, to look a lot like other people's religious practices. We don't like to call what we do magic or superstition, but we certainly historically have been very pleased to call other people's religion superstition.
I want to get into that as we go
That's
through the
wonderful
program.
Wonderful point.
Go ahead.
That's just a wonderful point, you know, that one man's religion is another man's superstition and vice versa. We really probably ought to sort of put on the table what we are going to define as a superstition.
Okay. Because one of my questions is define superstition. What is a superstitious practice?
I didn't mean to get ahead of you.
That's okay. Go ahead.
But I think that we would not call something a superstition that we have a evidence-based explanation for that, where we have a known causal relationship, where we can say that something clearly caused something. And so it's really the lack of that that makes something a superstition, where there's, you know, there is no real causal relationship between a black cat crossing your path. And so one could say that any religion is a superstition, but of course I'm too nice to say that on the air.
Well, one of my questions was, could those who follow the practices and procedures of mainline religions be accused in some cases of being superstitious because of the practices they indulge in and the beliefs they hold? But you're the religious studies professor here. Let me put you on the spot.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, when a lot of people in religious studies look at subjects such as superstition and religion, they first and foremost, rather than coming up with a definition, are interested in looking at how these categories are used out there in the world, in the social world, how people use them for themselves and against others.
And Scott, you're still sticking by your statement that you don't see a relationship here.
Well, there's definitely a relationship that people who are religious maybe use a lot of superstitions, but in our research and in some of the other research that's out there, there isn't a huge statistical relationship between somebody's religious belief and their superstitious belief. Not to say that they never occur together, but they certainly don't always occur together.
So I'll throw it back to you, Dr. McLeod, because you're the religious studies person here. Those people who follow mainline religions may look at what the practitioners of other religions who are fringe religions or religions that are viewed in some cases as cults or simply outside of the Western mindset mainstream as people following superstitious practices. How many of the superstitions that we know of today that are in common use stem from those kinds of faith-based practices?
You know, the whole human world in terms of supernatural things has historically always been very, very messy, right? So people belong to institutions that folks call religions. But at the same time, they practice all sorts of other things that they combine with what an outsider may say looks like other supernatural / religious practices together. Take it for that as few as 35% to as many as 60% of all Americans believe in ghosts today, yet very few of the religious traditions they belong to have any conception that there would be ghosts. I mean, this type of intermixing goes on all the time.
How many I'm not sure who to direct this question to. How many people out there in the world today or in America today hold serious superstitious beliefs?
Hard to say a number, but just a lot of people have some superstitious belief. I mean, just the number of people who believe in ghosts, for example. If you define superstition as something that is not shown by science to exist and a persistent belief in it, that's a superstition, I would say. And so people who believe in ghosts are superstitious then by definition.
So Scott,
and I agree with the earlier comments that that the line is pretty fuzzy about what's a religious superstition and what isn't, and the line between them, because it may be that that a superstition started as a religious one. Let's say crossing your fingers could have originated as a sort of handy way to make the sign of the cross. But does everybody who does that now think of it as a religious practice? I think not, and I think it's really pretty secular now.
So, Scott, what kind of people tend to be superstitious? I know that I think you looked into this in one of your studies.
Yeah, one of the things we looked at is what's called locus of control. And locus of control is basically whether or not a person believes that they're in control of their lives versus things outside of them that are in control of their lives. And you can either have an internal locus of control where you think that you're in control, or an external locus of control where you think other people are in control, or chance or fate in control. And one of the things that we found was that people that have a high external locus of control, they believe that other things are in control of their lives. They tended to endorse more superstitious beliefs.
So to put that in non-academic language, mm-hmm. people who believe—
If you think that other people are in control of your lives, or that chance and fate are in control of your lives, you're more likely to act on superstitions.
Can you change that? Can you be persuaded that chance and fate are not in control, that you, in fact, can exert some control over your life?
You know, I have never seen any research on that.
Okay.
Colloquially, just thinking about myself, I've confronted some people with some of their superstitions, and I find that they tend to become more entrenched in them. I don't know how common that is, so I'd be interested to hear what other people think about that.
Go ahead.
This might be a question for Scott that I'm just fascinated with, is that I'm familiar with Bader's work on paranormal beliefs and concepts and its relationship to those in unstable social and economic situations. People who don't have a lot of control tend to believe a lot more of those sorts of superstitious things. And again, I'm using that with quotes around it. But did you find the same thing in your research?
We didn't look directly at that, but I've read some other research on that, and you're absolutely right. When people feel like they're not in control of their environment, they tend to cling to their superstitions a little strongly. And one researcher even found that just asking people to think about past times when they felt like they were not in control made them believe in their superstitions more strongly.
So aside from that, do we know if certain people are more prone to be superstitious? For instance, is it breakdown according to education, gender, nationality, religious practice, things like that?
There's been a little bit looking at that, but it's kind of messy right now. There's been some studies that have found that women are more likely than men to be superstitious. Our study didn't find that, and other studies have not found that as well. So if there is a relationship there, it's probably a relatively small one. There's been some other research looking at age and education as a factor, and those results are also pretty mixed, with some studies finding that maybe as you get older and more educated, you're less likely to be superstitious, but other studies showing that there really isn't a relationship at all.
So, Dr. Nickel, you've traveled the world looking at this, and you were a detective once, and one of the things that you do as a senior research fellow for the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry is to look for the veracity or to debunk things out there that go bump in the night. What are some of the—
Let me clarify. Okay. We don't set out to debunk. That would be just as dishonest as setting out to promote a false belief. One should actually look at evidence. I mean, we wouldn't want a detective who went to a crime scene and immediately said, well, I haven't gone inside yet, but it's clearly a case of suicide. Just write it down. No, we would want him to actually survey the crime scene and not just have an opinion in advance of evidence. So what we're trying to do is actually investigate mysteries with a view towards solving them. Maybe we can talk a little more about that later.
Yeah, we will. I'm going to come back and ask you the question that I was going to ask you before we needed to get a definition of from your point of view about what you do. So we'll take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. We'll talk about superstition, and we'll try not to do anything bad in the break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Mary Chapin Carpenter and Sean Colvin. Acclaimed songwriters share the stage on Thursday, February 21st, in Knight Theater. Tickets at 704-372-1000. Well, we've all heard that talk is cheap and that actions speak louder than words, but that may not be right according to TED. TED is short for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. TED Talks use regular conferences to disseminate what they view as ideas worth spreading. And that's coming to Charlotte. We'll talk about the TED series and what's going to happen here tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, new reports tie safety failures at specialty pharmacies to deaths and illnesses over the past decade. Widespread problems at compounding pharmacies.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show today and each weekday morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on your NPR News Source, 90.7 WFAE. We are listener-funded radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're spending this hour talking about superstitions, their origins, whether they hold any water. Why? Because we couldn't help ourselves. We couldn't help ourselves playing this either.
Very superstitious.
Go, Stevie. All right. We're here with Scott Fluke, co-author of Reexamining the Form and Function of Superstition. He's a doctoral in psychology candidate at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Dr. Sean McLeod is in our studio, associate professor of religious studies at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Joe Nickel, senior research fellow for the Committee on Skeptical Inquiry. What are some of the more common superstitions out there? I don't know who to ask that question of, but jump in here. Dr. Nickel, let's start with you.
Well, I would say that anything is a superstition that's not based on evidence and causal effect, so that really there are just thousands of superstitions and you know, ghosts. Oftentimes when we talk about superstitions, we just list things like walking under ladders and rabbit's foot and knocking on wood, but those are pretty trivial ones, and larger ones. You mentioned ghosts, and those really have much more power over people's lives.
Yeah,
much more meaningful. I think I would say that there's really a difference in thinking. There are two basic types of thinking. One is what's called magical thinking, and that is that. With a lack of causal effect or a real explanation for something, we just kind of imagine something. And so, belief in witchcraft, belief in ghosts, belief that there are demonic forces, and so forth, would be of that order.
Yeah.
And the other type is rational thinking, where you do look to see if there's some actual evidence behind something and believe that whether you like it or not.
You know, I have added the phrase knock on wood to something I'm talking about that I think I don't want it to happen.
Sure.
Because it would be bad if it happened, so I'll say knock on wood. And you know, maybe I think we've all said God bless you when somebody sneezed. And many times we don't know the origin of these phrases and we don't believe that they hold any special powers whatsoever. We just do it because, you know, it couldn't hurt.
It's a social convention. It's a little thing that you do. It's part of the sort of the folk activity of our culture. It's something one does. Someone sneezes and you feel obliged to do something or say something, you know. And instead of excuse you, you say bless you. Mm-hmm. And the same with there's a sort of, I think when you use the word, say, a knock on wood, maybe you've said something and maybe you thought, oh, that sounds a little boastful or that sounds a little too optimistic. And so we use it, knock on wood, we're sort of harking back to an old superstition, but we're just using it today really as just a little social convention.
So Scott Fluke, in a situation like that, it's hard to tell whether the person is really superstitious or whether they're just repeating a phrase they've heard passed down for generations, and it's just something that's part of the language. So since everybody's superstitions are a little bit different, and sometimes you don't know if they have them or not, they're just saying the words, how do you study it? Because you've studied it.
That's a great question. There's a couple of ways you can go about studying it. One is to just put together a questionnaire and list a bunch of superstitions on them, kind of like a checklist, and see which ones people endorse. That's not my preferred method, but that's one that people have done. You can also try to get at more of a general belief that superstitions have an effect by asking questions like, I have attempted to change my luck and things like that. But a lot of researchers have gone to trying to measure superstition with a behavioral observable pattern. Mm-hmm. So they'll put their participants in kind of a situation to see if they can get any superstitions to pop out at them. For example, one research team had their participants play mini golf, and their definition of superstition was when people picked the same color golf ball after they saw that they made a hole in one or something like that.
Now, I went to Catholic school as a child, and I remember when I first started to read the newspaper every day has, except maybe the New York Times, has the horoscope column. So I used to read my horoscope, and then one of the nuns in class said, don't read that. That's just stupid, superstitious trash, and it's unchristian, and it's not Catholic. It's a horoscope, a superstition, if you read it and believe it and try to follow it every day?
I would say so. We define superstition as a cause and effect. If you think that something is causing something else when really it's not, it's superstitious. So horoscopes are about believing that when you were born during the time of year has some sort of causal effect on the rest of your life.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, and I agree with that completely. I think exactly clarified there is no real cause and effect. The pull on your body from the planet Mars, to say the least, is inconsequential. And you could test horoscopes pretty easily by taking the sign off of them and cutting them out and scrambling them and letting people pick. Which one of these best fits what happened to you yesterday?
I actually believe that's what goes on in these horoscope columns. The January 15th Aquarius paragraph is going to show up in the Aries thing in November sometime. it's very strange. So let's talk about some of the more common superstitions out here. Why is it believed that breaking a mirror brings bad luck, much less 7 years bad luck? Dr. McLeod, do you know the answer to that?
Again, I think Joe is completely right in saying that there are so many origin stories it's hard to actually grasp it. But we can look in the past and see how things were used at certain times by certain people. And the American Southeast in particular, it was long a tradition to think that the soul was somehow captured inside of a mirror. This was especially the case with evangelicals in the late 19th, early 20th century, so much so that you would have people not just not wanting to break mirrors, but covering mirrors when there was a death in the family so that the soul that was floating around would not appear.
And that's a Jewish tradition, is
mm-hmm.
it not? When
yes.
you sit Shiva, you cover the mirror.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because if your likeness could be captured by the mirror, then by extension couldn't your soul be captured. Even similar superstitions among some native peoples that in earlier times that the camera.
Yes, I was going to talk about that.
Having your picture made might, you know, it captures your likeness and therefore might capture your essence.
Well, let me ask a question about that, because when indigenous populations believed that, they wouldn't allow their pictures to be taken by a camera because they thought it would capture part of their soul. We in the Western world viewed that as ludicrous. And yet, we do some of the same things with regard to covering mirrors at a person's death. So what is the difference?
Well, I think there's no difference. I think it's just very, very analogous, and only tradition might explain the difference, you know, mm-hmm. if you have a tradition of doing one and not the other. People maybe don't cover mirrors anymore. I'm not aware of that being very common anymore. But as recently as, you know, the Abraham Lincoln White House, I think they covered the mirrors during Lincoln's after Lincoln's death. I believe that's so, if I'm not mistaken. And so that was a superstition, or at least if it wasn't intended as a superstition, it was, again, a cultural practice, part of the sort of mourning ritual that made sense to people. Yeah. And those kinds of things carry on in a very secular way for a long, long, long time.
Dr. McLeod.
And another thing has to do, again, with the social power. Is the dominant group's prayer going to be counting as magic? Because everything we've talked about today, to be cheeky about this, prayers that are hoping to cure sicknesses, cure illnesses, cure cancer, this is apotropaic magic, right? But if the majority, the folks who have the power to define the terms, are using this, they're not going to say, no, I'm practicing magic and superstition.
Yeah. You religious studies people are very dangerous people to have on the air. But let's get back to the 7 years bad luck. Why 7 years bad luck if you break a mirror? Do you know the answer to that question?
Well, there's certainly mysticism involving certain numbers, the number 3, the number 7, the number 13, which you mentioned. 7, of course, symbolic of the creation, but the number 7 is all through the Bible and used in many different ways, I believe. Maybe I'm not the best person to speak of that, but it's certainly a mystical number.
And there is a history. Again, we're talking about popular religious practice here, maybe not what some of the leaders of religious groups wanted. But throughout the 19th century, American Christians, a variety of them, were numerologists, mm-hmm. right? They thought that they could affect the physical world by use of their Bible as a talisman and doing certain types of numerology. I mean, the Puritans were even doing this sort of stuff, just 19th century.
That's kind of hocus pocus, isn't it?
Well, and other forms, that's a very good point, and bibliomancy, where you, for example, I grew up with this in my little hometown in eastern Kentucky. People would occasionally just open the Bible kind of at random and put their finger down the page and see if a verse could seem to answer a question or something. So there are a lot of those kinds of practices, I think.
So why do we say knock on wood when we don't want things bad to happen, or we do want good things to happen? Why do we say that? Where did that come from?
Well, it may have come from the medieval period, say, maybe in Celtic England, where there were beliefs that there were spirits residing in trees. But again, you know, I've seen that in several places, but an alternative is that it may have the wood might have been the symbol of the cross, the crucifixion. There were widespread pieces of the cross, you know, were very common in the Middle Ages. So many that one skeptic said there were enough pieces of the true cross to build a ship. But who knows exactly? But however it came about doesn't matter as much as that you can sort of track in relatively modern times how it's used.
If you spill salt, you're supposed to throw it over your left shoulder, your right shoulder? I don't know which shoulder. But you're supposed to throw it over your shoulder. Do we know where that came from?
Well, the idea of spilling salt probably comes from the idea that it was a very precious commodity at some point and was not considered, therefore, a socially a good thing to do. It was careless. It was, you know, not the thing to do. As to which shoulder you throw it over or the practice, again, we say, well, I don't know which shoulder it is. Maybe I've got it wrong. No, you're just as right as the next fellow. It changes over time. You're more apt, and this is some of my graduate work was done in folklore. What's more likely to survive is that you throw salt over your shoulder than the particular shoulder that you throw it over.
Okay.
People will remember, oh, you throw it over your shoulder. The same with picking up pennies. You know, do you pick up a penny when it's is it a lucky penny when it's heads up or tails up? Answer.
Well, what makes a lucky penny? Wait, stop. What makes a lucky penny lucky? I mean, it's just a penny.
Well, that's right. It was a bigger deal in earlier
yes.
times. And now that Canada has gotten rid of its pennies, what are they to do? Well, I'll tell you, they're going to look for nickels.
That's right. Now, carrying a rabbit's foot around for good luck seems to be something that goes through cultures. Many different cultures believe this, and it dates back, I believe, to the 7th century. What's the story behind rabbit's feet being something you carry around for good luck? And people still do this. They're on keychains everywhere.
They are, and I have one nearby.
Why?
Well, again, you got me with the 7th century. I have no idea where that comes from. But again, some people say it's Celtic. It's certainly common in Britain. The idea may be that rabbits were lucky because they're so prolific. And you know, anyone can tell you that rabbits breed pretty fast, and so that may be that the idea that anything connected with them would proliferate. That if you use it for good luck,
of course, I would think that you got so many people carrying around rabbits' feet that would make the animal very unlucky.
Exactly, I was going to use that joke. But you beat me to it.
Dr. McLeod.
And the funny thing about this is to me, and it goes back, we can talk about rabbits and black cats together, because if you look at the 14 through the 1600s, you find that witches' familiars weren't just black cats, but they were dogs, they were rabbits. They were toads. They were birds. But then over time, the Victorian era in particular makes black cats, a certain domestic animal, more popular out of as a witch's familiar.
Were these the kinds of things, Scott, that you looked at it in terms of the people involved in your study? Were these the kinds of superstitions that they had, or were they different kinds of superstitions?
Well, we looked at some of the more common social superstitions, but I think I'm more interested in the ones that are more specific to an individual person. I feel like those are the ones that are more powerful, the ones you sort of come up with on your own.
People come up with their own superstitions based on what? Because something happened to them in the past and they associated that was a Tuesday that had happened and I had coffee with no sugar that morning. So if I want something good to happen to me, I'm going to get up and make coffee with no sugar. Is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly right, yeah. People are really, really good at noticing patterns in their environment. That's one of our biggest assets. Unfortunately, we're so good at that sometimes we notice patterns that aren't actually there. Just because one thing happens before another, we tend to assume that one caused another.
So this is like these athletes they had a big game, they won, and they forgot to shave that morning, so they never shave on game day.
Yep, and now hockey players don't shave for a month at a time.
That's right. And the mention earlier of using a certain color golf ball or something like that, there are people who have their favorite jersey, and they wear that all the time. Maybe this is a good time to mention that this issue of confirmation bias.
Right.
Maybe we'll wait.
Okay. All right, we will.
The music.
The orchestra is playing, and so we must go. We're coming right back with Scott Fluke, Dr. Sean McLeod, Dr. Joe Nickel. We're talking about superstitions this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Stay with us. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Levine Cancer Institute, part of Carolina's healthcare system, offering hope to those battling cancer by focusing on advances in cancer prevention, detection, diagnosis, and treatment. Details at levinecancerinstitute.org. News reports tie safety features at specialty pharmacies to deaths and illnesses over the past decade. A panel joins Diane Rehm to talk about widespread problems at compounding pharmacies coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show here on WFAE. But if you'd like to join our conversation, it might be good luck for you. You never know. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE. Or you can do it online. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Julie Hack of Donald Hack Diamonds in Charlotte talks about underwriting on WFAE.
Business owners ask me all the time whether they should partner with WFAE, and I say of course, because of the quality of programming and the consistency of the message. Donald Hack Diamonds has been an underwriter for WFAE for over 17 years. To me, Donald Hack Diamonds and WFAE are a perfect fit.
For more information, email underwriting@WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about superstitions. Dr. Joe Nichols, Senior Research Fellow for the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, brought up this superstition, so we just couldn't resist. We must knock on wood. Okay. We got that out of our system. Scott Fluke is co-author of Reexamining the Form and Function of Superstition. He's a school psychology doctoral candidate at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He joins us from there. Dr. Joe Nichols is also with us, senior research fellow for the Committee on Skeptical Inquiry. And Dr. Sean McLeod is in our studio, associate professor of religious studies at UNC Charlotte. Let's go back to what we were talking about just prior to the break, confirmation bias. What
well, Mike,
is that?
That's something that's very crucial to understanding how we do a lot of things. We see something happen. Let's say we've noticed that we're lucky a few times, and we think back on it. We say, "Oh, that was when I wore the red jersey."
Mm-hmm.
And so now you've got an idea. Maybe that has some effect. And pretty soon you start, as we might say, counting the hits and ignoring the misses. Whenever you are wearing the red jersey and you win, you count that as evidence for it. When you do something else, then you say, well, that doesn't matter, or you just don't even notice it. You don't notice the things that don't fit your preconceived notion. And this is important across the board. When people cite evidence for things, people describe their ghost experiences and so forth, quite often they're using confirmation bias. They've got a notion that Aunt Matilda is going to call, and whenever Aunt Matilda calls, see, there it is. There's something. I knew it. I had a feeling that Aunt Matilda was going to call, and she called.
Okay.
And when she doesn't, when you have that feeling but she doesn't call, you just forget it. Just passes right out of your head. So your bias is due to seeking confirmation.
Yeah, and I can back that up with a personal story about the confirmation bias vividness effect. So I grew up in a small northern Indiana rural town, lived next to a woman who said that she could tell portents of the future. So what were some of the portents she said she could tell? When a raven lands on her yard within 3 days, one of her neighbor's relatives will die. So the confirmation bias suggests she probably saw a crow in her yard 50 times, 100 times. But once during that, and this is the vividness effect, it's a dramatic event, somebody does die within 3 or 4 days of seeing that. So she remembers that and ignores all the other things that statistically are more significant.
Exactly.
I don't know who to answer this question, but I'll ask it to Scott first. And that is there harm in any of these beliefs? Is there harm in the fact that you may think that 13 is an unlikely unlucky number?
There can be harm. It's harmful when the superstitions take the place of a more adaptive behavior. For example, if you picture a student studying for a final, if you study hard and work hard and do your homework and then show up to the final prepared and bring a good luck charm, it's not going to do any harm. But on the opposite, if you trust your good luck charm so much that you don't study, then you're not going to be prepared for the test, and superstition will be one of the reasons for that.
Let's go back, Scott, to this thing about football players not shaving on game day or wearing the certain color jersey when your team is playing because they win when you wear that jersey, things like that. You've studied the relationship between an action, an object, or ritual and an unrelated outcome. How do you know that outcome is unrelated?
Well, the best way to figure that out is to test it. And the way you would do that is you would have the person wear the jersey at sometimes and wear the jersey not sometimes and compare winning percentages. But that's not something that people are interested in doing. It's just it's just easier just to trust the lucky jersey.
And I think though that's exactly the correct answer is you can test such a thing, but it's just not practical. But you can at least see kind of do a sort of thought experiment in which you say, why would carrying a particular item in your pocket, how would that have an effect on your luck? How would it? What are the mechanisms by which that would take place? And the answer most people would say is, well, it just does. It's just magic. Mm. And that's your sign that it's magical thinking. If you can say that, we know that if you drink a poison, that's not a superstition. If you drink a poison, you'll get sick because of you can explain the causal relationship. Mm-hmm. And when you can't show that there's a cause and effect, you can't show it, can't even reasonably explain something that might make it work, pretty good idea that it's a superstition.
The belief that the number 13 is unlucky is said to be the most common superstition. Commercial buildings, at least in this country, eliminate that floor because the superstition is so strong. So you go from the 12th floor to the 14th floor. It is thought that this comes, I'm told, from Christianity. Some people will ask for new license plate numbers or new addresses because their address or their license plate contains the number 666, which is the sign of the beast, the devil. I've read that crossing your fingers may have originated when Christianity was illegal as a secret sign of a person's belief in Christ. Again, religion is the origin of these superstitions. Where would organized religion come down on those things today, Dr. McLeod?
There are so many different organized religions out there, right? So some people are in religious groups in which these things are completely acceptable. A lot of other religious groups would, of course, see them as not acceptable.
And yet some of the followers, some of the practitioners still hold those beliefs or practice those beliefs.
Most
still
certainly.
Cross their fingers. If the church, whichever church, whether it's the Christian church or some other church, frowns on that. How do you explain the ongoing practice of this among believers?
And perhaps Scott's work helps here with this is that, people pick and mix a lot of different ideas and practices, and a lot of these ideas and practices have to do with a search for order, a search for control, a search for predictability.
Well, Scott, you discovered that those who believe that chance or fate control their lives are more likely to be superstitious. And some religious believers believe in predestination or that God is in control, not them. Would they be then more likely to be superstitious?
Probably on an average, yeah, they probably would be. I can't speak to necessarily why that relationship would be there, but I would guess so. Mm-hmm.
And to jump in here, so the New England Puritans we stereotype, right, as being the most kind of a staid, restrictive group of American Protestants and European Protestants in history. But from our modern perspective, they were full of magical practices, and they were predestinarian, right? They knew that they were damned or saved before they were born, and they were spending their lives frequently trying to figure out which one they were.
So, Scott, you got interested in this topic in part because some of the things you witnessed while you were at school. You say it boggled your mind that some students would take Lucky Charms. I'm assuming that's not the cereal, but Lucky Charms with them into class at test time rather than study for the test. My first question about that is, how did these people get into college?
Well, they must have been smart to begin with, but superstitions are just that common, even among people that are very intelligent, otherwise very successful, very practical, very rational. Superstitions are just really easy to believe in. It's really easy to fall into that trap of seeing a relationship that's not actually there.
And there are no scientific studies that show Lucky Charm cereal to be less effective than shredded wheat for
that's true.
You know, pre-exam preparation. I think that one thing we have to keep in mind is that when we have better evidence for something, when we do have a cause and effect, I think most reasonable people are prepared to pay attention to that. It's when there's really nothing that you can do. I mean, you can prepare and be a safe driver, but there's nothing to keep you absolutely from having an accident. So you might think, well, you'll just get a little ahead by a little, you know, won't hurt if you have a religious medallion hanging in your cars.
I guess you could say that luck, the belief in good or bad luck or both, is somewhat superstitious. Is there a connection, Scott? I mean, if a lot of people seem to have a lot of bad luck. They have car accidents. They lose jobs. They lose a promotion at work to somebody else. They get hurt doing some benign activity and nobody else would have a problem with. And they just say, well, bad luck for that person. Is it bad luck or is it something they're doing?
Sometimes it may just be bad luck. You're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that's one of those things that we can't control and that we really want to have control of, especially when it comes to job promotions or not getting hit by a car. But superstitions are more likely when the cost of doing the superstition is really low, but the potential benefit is really high. It's kind of like a just-in-case effect. So if you're in a situation where crossing your fingers or having good luck charm doesn't really cost you much and it might have a really big effect, you're more likely to do it.
So are you telling me that luck exists?
Depending on how you define it, I wouldn't say that there's a mystical force out there that is determining our fate. But if I flip a coin and it comes up heads instead of tails, then that's pretty much lucky because I don't have any control over the outcome.
Dr. Nickel?
Yes, I agree. Depending on how you define luck, most luck is distributed pretty equally, good luck and bad luck, except, of course, we can influence it by our behavior. Obviously, you're going to be more unlucky if you're careless. And maybe that walking under a ladder that we mentioned, maybe one good reason not to walk under a ladder is that the workman up there may drop something on you. And that kind of behavior of carelessly walking under a ladder where somebody's working might make things a little more likely to be bad luck than good luck.
Let me share.
They're probably not going to drop cash on you.
Let me share some comments that have come in via email and Facebook and places like that while we've been talking here. Blake on Facebook says prayer is far better than superstition, which is nothing more than a violation of the first commandment: "You shall have no other gods before me." Dr. McNichol, you want to comment on that? Do you have anything to say?
I'm revealing my own bias, but I think that I would consider prayer to be not an evidence-based method, that it would rely on confirmation bias.
I meant to say Dr. McLeod, not Dr. McNichol, but go ahead, Dr. McLeod.
What Joe said. Again, one person's superstition is another person's religion.
Okay. You know? Amy emails, "I'm Jewish, and my mother would never allow us to issue a compliment like, 'Look how cute your granddaughter is,' without spitting or poo-pooing to keep the evil eye away. How did this superstition originate?" A lot of Mediterranean cultures believe in the evil eye. What is that? What is the evil eye? Anybody know what the evil eye is? Nobody knows?
it's not something we have in our culture very much. It's a belief that someone can put a curse on you, either by looking at you a certain way, or there are other ways you could get the evil eye. But it's like any superstition. They have cultural roots, but they're fundamentally, we recognize them as a superstition because there's no real cause and effect going on. It's believed by magical thinking. So it fits the pattern that we've been discussing, and I think we're in pretty good agreement on.
Okay,
Scott. What a superstition is, and the rest doesn't so much matter as to, you know, where does it come from and so forth is a little bit academic, because the main thing is to realize that it has all the earmarks of a superstition.
So Scott was Scott emails that we were talking earlier about seeing your reflection in a mirror and the superstition surrounding that, and you're having your image being captured by a camera with regard to capturing your soul. And Scott emails, what about having your picture painted or seeing your reflection in water? Are there superstitions similar to the mirror and the camera surrounding those things? Do we know? No one knows. Okay. Kayla emails, going back to breaking a mirror, if someone does so and is superstitious, is there any evidence of a Macbeth effect, seeing things that you expect to see?
Well, it sounds to me like the confirmation bias.
Okay.
Yeah, anything that you do, I mean, if you break a mirror, and I have some experience with this because quite often here at the Center for Inquiry in Amherst, New York, we have just a challenge and try to promote critical thinking. We'll have a superstition bash. We usually hold it on Friday the 13th. We set up an obstacle course. You have to walk under a ladder, and you have to come indoors and open up your umbrella. And of course, the sidewalk, we invite you to step on the cracks and so forth. Now, I've broken many a mirror in this servitude, and it turns out that some bad things have happened to me, because as soon as you just say, let's do anything today and then tomorrow see what happens, but we're looking just for bad luck, just bad things happen, well, some bad things will happen.
Now, the good news here, Scott, is that your studies suggest that those who believe in superstitions associated with good things happening report having higher life satisfaction than those who believed in negative superstitions. So should we just alter our behavior and believe that knocking on wood helps?
Well, there is some evidence that superstition can be good for you. We've spent a lot of time today talking about all the bad sides of it, and there are definitely a lot of bad sides. But superstition can be good when you do it in addition to other things, because it makes you feel more confident.
Couldn't hurt. Scott Fluke, co-author of Reexamining the Form and Function of Superstition at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, Dr. Joe Nickel, senior research fellow at the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, and Dr. Sean McLeod, associate professor of religious studies at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for the hour.